This is an ad by BetterHelp. What are your self-care non-negotiables? It's hard to make time for the things that keep you healthy, but being consistent with self-care is like working a muscle. And when life gets crazy, that muscle keeps you strong. Therapy is the ultimate self-care, and BetterHelp makes it easy to get started with affordable online sessions you can do from anywhere. Never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com today to get 10% off your first month.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, joined by the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baraki. What's going on, man?
Hey, doing all right. Working in the hospital. Training's going well.
I mean, this makes sense. Again, the balance in the universe has been restored. I don't know. Like, I've just had, I was sick last week. And then this particular week, I'm not very strong. So then your training must be going well. I mean, that's
I'm not overwhelmingly strong, but that's not actually what I'm necessarily training for at the moment. I'm doing, you know, plenty of running, plenty of rowing, and actually still lifting as well. And strength is hanging in there, doing all right.
Yeah, so. That's fair. Not fair enough. To be clear, it's fine. Training is not a super high priority for me as far as like maximal strength, but I still enjoy it. And I just saw this weird thing obviously on social media, which. Terrible place to be. I do wonder how civilization would be without social media. Like, where would we be behind? Would we be ahead? Like, what would I do with all my free time? Someone's like, no one likes strength training. I'm like, I love strength training. Like, I do. I love going to the gym. Yeah, and I like it, but it was like no one loves strength training, but you just go do it, right?
I see.
And I'm like, no, I like it. I do. I enjoy it. I don't always enjoy not being strong as I want to be. Like that part of it, you know, but doing it, participating in it, it's not like type 2 fun where it's fun afterwards or type 3 fun where it's like terrifying, we'll never do again, but like happy I did it. It's type 1 fun. Like I like it while I'm doing it. So maybe that's, you know, I wonder, there's obviously a number of factors, like not only your environment, like how you were introduced to it, your value system and so on. Certainly genetic component, I would imagine as well. But like, as far as how you respond to training, but like getting bit by that bug, like what, like if somebody could like encapsulate that into like something very, you know, scalable and we could just infect everybody. Hey, look, oh, now you love it too. Cool. You know?
Yeah. I mean, in the same way that different people get different amounts of enjoyment or pleasure out of like eating a particular type of food, I suspect that there's a wide variation in like the runner's high that people get out of, you know, aerobic endurance type activity, same out of the pump and everything in between. You know, there's also, you know, another variable there that I recognize as being important is like the way the training is set up can have a big impact on that. Cause you'll hear a lot of lifters and just a lot of people in general, you know, lament how miserable it is to do conditioning or to do cardio or something. And by and large, the vast majority of these people are just doing it too hard. And if they were to back off a bit and actually let themselves adapt a little bit, then it becomes a lot more enjoyable. You actually don't have to go that hard. So that's something that I've been experiencing in the past 6 months or so with like a much more heavy conditioning focus. At first, it didn't feel awesome, but now it actually feels quite good to even do pretty sustained efforts. And I'm usually keeping my heart rate relatively constrained, capped at a particular target. And then same in strength training, people who, you know, are miserable with their training and dread sessions and, you know, like, well, might be taking sets all the way to failure, might be actually failing sets, or they might not be enjoying it because they're not actually seemingly responding, in which case also the programming would probably need to be adjusted. So getting the dosage and the formulation right for the person is probably, it's not guaranteed to make it super enjoyable for the person, but I think it sets them up favorably for that in the same way it does for conditioning as well.
Yep. To the runner's high, I've only had it one time and it's a distinct experience, core memory. I remember I was interviewing at UCLA for a residency spot. And I'd gotten there to Los Angeles. I believe I was staying in somewhere near Manhattan Beach, which was a mistake in hindsight, just like traffic wise to get to UCLA, although it was on a Saturday, so it ended up being fine. Anyway, long story long, I guess I went for a run after my residency interview, and I ran down by the ocean, and it started raining, which is rare in Southern California, but pouring rain. And I'm just like, I don't know if I had like a training montage going on in my head, like, you know, Eye of the Tiger, something's playing. I'm soaked and I'm just running and I feel on top of the world. And I remember I got back to the place I was staying and I was like, I'll just keep going. I went running for maybe another 20 minutes or something like that, got back and I was like, what the hell just happened? Never again. It's never happened since.
Never recapture that that feeling again. Elusive.
Yeah. And you know, as the years pass from that experience, the run keeps getting more and more longer and faster and better and whatever. I'm going to be, you know, 60 years old. Like, yes, whenever I run a marathon, an accident. It was probably like an hour run or something. Anyway, before we get into this week's podcast, we're doing It's Great Debates and we got a mystery case. But I did want to make a series of announcements. We haven't really promoted these things. So thing one. We have a whole new suite of tools available under our resources page. So if you go on our website, you navigate on the toolbar down to About Us, there's a resources tab. You click on resources. We've got a suite of tools. One is like a calorie calculator. One helps get your macros to a particular point. There's some adjustment in there based on your dietary preferences. There's a max heart rate and training zone calculator if you're a five zone person. We've got a tool available for you to help calculate your sort of ranges for heart rate zones. We've got a one rep max calculator. We've got a total daily energy expenditure calculator. It's all free. So you can check that out under the resources tab. Also, the Android app is live. It's available. The Google Play Store, it's free. And so if you're a Green Bubble person, you can go check that out. It's free. And it's super useful to have the app, whether you're on iPhone, your iOS, or you're on Android, because you can get the first week of all of our templates free for free. So if you were like on the fence, like, oh, should I do power building? Should I do, you know, hypertrophy? Should I do strength? Whatever. You can get the first week or a rehab template, even if you've got shoulder pain, you know, and maybe that's all you need. Just 1 week of kind of like changing stuff up and natural regression to the mean that just takes its course and you're back ready to go. That's available. Again, it's free. And then we also have a template quiz on our website that I've linked in the description below. So speaking to templates, have that. That's available for you. You can check the link in the description. And yep, we will get the calculators also on the app. There's a series of updates coming on the apps. But so whether, no matter what kind of cell phone that you have, Barbell Medicine's got you covered. Okay, let's transition now into the mystery case. These are real cases that I present to Dr. Baraki whenever we do these podcasts. So real patients, real experiences. And the idea here is not only some infotainment where I just, we get to peer inside the lens of Baraki's brain and he walks us through his sort of thinking strategies, but also some clinical pearls at the end. Ideally, this is helpful for not only health and fitness professionals, but also strength enthusiasts or training enthusiasts, exercise enthusiasts in general. There's usually some correlation there. So people like when I predict whether or not you're going to get this, I think that you're going to arrive in the general realm of the correct diagnosis. But I will be very surprised if you get the specific diagnosis.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not a cancer, to be clear. But if you
don't have
recall,
you don't have to qualify all this stuff.
No. This is for the listeners at home because, like, we had a particular type of sort of what was thought to be a cancerous growth. You're like, well, it'd be very difficult to arrive at the specific pathology without looking at it under the microscope and being expert in that. So
yeah.
Okay. Are you ready for this?
Sure.
All right, let's do it. So this was a 21-year-old black college football player with no past medical history, presents to the emergency department due to severe, sharp chest pain. Prior to presentation, the patient was exercising and he had benched 405 for one rep. The chest pain started. Yeah, solid for sure. The patient, the chest pain started immediately thereafter, along with shortness of breath, and the patient describes it as being constant since then, located right under the sternum. He's never had this before, and he has no chronic medical problems. He states both of his parents are still alive and without any chronic medical issues. He denies any history of DVT, pulmonary embolism, or heart disease in his family. His review of systems is negative for recent constitutional symptoms. So that's like fever, weight loss, things like that. Loss of consciousness or visual changes, any leg swelling, cough, or wheezing. His vital signs were within normal limits on admission. So before we go any further, any thoughts?
Yeah. So we have a 21-year-old, previously healthy male with really, really abrupt onset chest pain and associated shortness of breath in the context of exercise. And this chest pain seems to be localized in the substernal region, relatively central. And so I think we've done a couple cases before that involve some chest pain and some chest pain and shortness of breath. So I've talked about the initial kind of way that we typically think about this. This is a condition that is clearly localized to the chest somewhere in the thorax. And when we combine both chest pain and shortness of breath, most often that kind of localizes us to something relating to the heart or the associated structures, you know, of the heart, including the aorta as well as the lungs. And then there's also, you know, technically the space in between them or around them called the mediastinum, where things can happen in that kind of area as well. There's other, you know, surrounding structures that we keep in mind, but the first and foremost priorities are going to be some kind of a pathology relating to the heart, the cardiovascular system, or the pulmonary system. So that's kind of my first kind of branch point here. The other aspect of this is just how abrupt this seemingly onset. And so then I think about just the general types of things that can happen so suddenly, as far as like the types of pathologies that can onset that quickly. And so typically tend to think about, did something break or fracture? Did something rupture, like a blood vessel or something like that? Did a lung collapse? Is there a tube that's blocked or obstructed in some way? Is there a clot that's occluded something all of a sudden? Did something spasm all of a sudden? Those are just various types of pathologies that can happen very suddenly. And so that's kind of going to be the way that I think about this moving forward. I have the, you know, anatomic kind of localization of this problem in mind, and I'm going to overlay that with what kinds of things can happen super suddenly in this territory as we move forward. The fact that his vital signs are reassuring is great. You know, a cardiovascular catastrophe would not typically present with completely normal vital signs. A pulmonary catastrophe would also not typically present with completely normal vital signs. And so I'm wondering, you know, it's not that normal vital signs are going to, you know, completely exonerate those systems, but, you know, it would be very, you know, possible for somebody to have something outside of those organs that leads to pain in this area, say something relating to the ribs, for example, or something involving the pleura, something like that, that can lead to this kind of sharp chest pain and maybe some shortness of breath without having a massive systemic effect on his blood pressure, his heart rate, something like that. But it's too soon to go quite that far. So first priorities would be heart, lungs, and look for the sudden emergencies.
There you go. All right. Well, let's get into some exam, some lab stuff, and some imaging. So physical exam was overall unremarkable, save for an elevated body mass. And in fact, his BMI was 39. Urinary tox screen was negative for cocaine and all other stimulants. Lipid test was done in the ED, was within normal limits. He had an EKG done, as you would expect, in the emergency department, which showed sinus rhythm with a right bundle branch block. They did cardiac enzymes as well. So his troponin was 0.53 at admission. And I'll just give you his hospital day one troponin. So 24 hours later is 10.43. And so a normal troponin is between 0 and 0.04. Do you want to take people through just what troponin is or like what you're thinking about when you're measuring that?
Yeah. Is that all the data that I get right now?
No. There's more stuff to come, but I just wanted to pause for the troponin.
Sure. Yeah. Troponin is a protein that is found very specifically in cardiac muscle cells. And so it's something that should be contained within the cell and should not really be detectable in the blood. And so when we can detect it in the blood, it is suggestive that something is going on with the muscle cells of the heart. They are necrosing or getting injured or popping open or damaged, injured in some way. And that is leading to inappropriate release of this protein into the blood. And so these levels, I mean, this is on an older troponin test. We have newer ones now that the scale is a bit different, but going from 0.5, which is already, you know, technically elevated even on the older lab test, up to 10 is very, very elevated. And so that would get anybody's attention pretty quickly for something going on with the heart muscle cells.
Yep. His myoglobin was also elevated to 412 on admission. Normal range is 0 to 90. CKMB was 11.1 at admission and 53.4 on hospital day one. Normal for that is 0 to 5. He had a transthoracic echocardiogram, which was also ordered in the emergency department, which was unremarkable. He had a transthoracic, a minor patent foramen ovale. He had a CT chest that was negative for aortic dissection. Had a coronary angiography that showed mild plaque disease in the middle left anterior descending branch. So before we go any further, that is the information that you received this time. Any thoughts based on that information?
Oh, this feel almost spoiled that I get all of this information so quickly. Normally, this would take a bit longer to work through this whole process. But especially the echo would not typically happen immediately. So just to be clear, that echo, all it showed was a minor PFO, yes. And that's it.
Okay. Yep.
All right. So we have this young, previously healthy patient who showed up with very acute onset chest pain, shortness of breath in the context of exercise. Most of his testing is pretty reassuring, except for the most concerning findings of evidence of what we would call myocardial injury or acute myocardial injury. And so the our job now is to basically determine what is impacting his heart muscle cells. Why are his heart muscle cells dying and leading to the release of these markers into the blood? And so there are a variety of different reasons this can happen. And so it's handy to have some of this additional evaluation. The most common and most concerning cause would be ischemia and infarction. In other words, not enough oxygenated blood flow getting to that heart muscle, leading it to die. That's what everybody listening would recognize as a heart attack. And that would lead to this type of a presenting syndrome, would lead to an increase in the blood troponin levels. They would rise up and then they would fall down over time. I would, you know, oftentimes we see a little bit more EKG abnormalities when that happens than what this patient had. And so sure enough, by the time they go in and they do what's called a coronary angiography, where they go and actually look at the blood flow to his heart muscle, it showed seemingly mild plaque, but not any kind of actual occlusion, no thrombus in the blood vessel to explain what would otherwise look like a heart attack. There are other things that can happen to lead to this involving the coronaries. So, for example, sometimes you can get a blood clot, and then by the time you go in and look, it's actually been broken down and dissolved. That's one thing that can happen. You can have a coronary dissection, which would be apparent on a coronary angiogram, which does not appear to be the case here. You can have coronary vasospasm, where one of those blood vessels has spasmed, like I said, all of a sudden, and can lead to the same manifestations, even though there's not a blood clot in there. Sometimes that can be apparent on a coronary angiogram, but sometimes it's also relaxed by the time they go and look. And so there are other ways that this can happen. There's this phenomenon called MINOCA, which stands for M-I-N-O-C-A, myocardial infarction with no obstructive coronary artery disease. So patients who don't have coronary artery disease who still happen to have a myocardial infarction or a heart attack for some reason. So all of those would be things that are possible in this scenario. Outside of issues leading to limited blood flow to the heart muscle, there are also other things that can cause the heart muscle to become injured and die. There's something called a stress cardiomyopathy, or what's also known by its Japanese term, Takotsubo cardiomyopathy, that can happen with kind of profound physiologic stress, adrenergic kind of activation. It's what people sometimes know as like a broken heart syndrome. Most of the time in like significant situations of very intense negative emotional stress, although apparently I learned that like 10% of them can happen in situations of very positive emotional experiences. But most of the time that syndrome happens in older women and is not would not be typical for this type of a scenario. And then other things that can impact the heart muscle can be direct injury or inflammation, infection of the heart muscle itself. So patients can have myocarditis, which is something that probably a lot of people heard or, you know, in recent years in the news quite a bit. That is something that can cause this, but would not be, you wouldn't expect it to onset so suddenly like this. Like he was completely fine and then all of a sudden to get myocarditis. Same thing with some kind of blunt traumatic injury. If you get just like a thudded in the chest really, really hard, it can cause some injury to muscle cells. It's not unusual, for example, after patients get CPR for them to have some of these, muscle cells that get injured and some of these proteins get released in the blood. So I could keep going. There's a whole list of possible ways that could lead to heart muscle cells getting injured. The list of them narrows a bit when I notice that this troponin level is going up very quickly. And when this patient has undergone an echocardiogram, the ultrasound, that looked pretty normal, that actually exonerates a lot of different possibilities, as well as the coronary angiogram that also rules out certain possibilities, but not all. So I'm still concerned, for example, this patient could have something like, have had something like a coronary vasospasm. They could have had a thrombus that then dissolved and opened back up. They could have a MINOCA type syndrome. They could have, you know, I suppose coronary vasculitis, that would be unusual again to onset so quickly. That wouldn't really fit here either. As well as like the direct trauma to the chest, potentially leading to this troponin elevation to go up and come back down. So there's a few possibilities for things that I'm thinking about.
Yeah. So they ended up calling this an NSTEMI. So the old non-ST wave elevation myocardial infarction. He was started on the protocol for acute coronary syndrome. So he's given an aspirin, statin, ACE inhibitor, beta blocker, IV heparin. And his cardiac enzymes trended down over the next 3 days. He was discharged on aspirin, Plavix, and a statin, and some cardiopulmonary rehab, which he went through 6 sessions of before withdrawing. And now the pivot that you've been waiting for. 5 months later, the patient returned to the emergency department with a second episode of chest pain that suddenly onset, again, while lifting weights, this time after heavy deadlifts. He said the episode was similar to the last, but the pain was not as intense. In the emergency department, he got aspirin, nitroglycerin, and morphine, which reduced his pain. And this time, his vital signs were significant for elevated blood pressure to 150 over 91, but otherwise, his vital signs were stable. The patient said he had not been taking his medication for about a week, and on exam, on this admission, was the same as the last, pretty much unremarkable on physical exam. His EKG showed bradycardia and T-wave inversions on the inferior leads. His cardiac enzymes were elevated again, although not as much as last time. So his troponin was 0.08, so slightly elevated. His myoglobin was 133, otherwise pretty unremarkable. Coronary angiography was performed again, and this time it found a large thrombus in the middle LAD, so left anterior descending branch, and a stent was placed, a bare stent was placed. And the additional imaging he had done at the time showed they did an ultrasound of his lower extremities, which was negative for DVT. Any thoughts based on this sort of pivot and representation?
Yeah, super interesting. This time, you know, the difference that we're seeing is that he actually did seem to have a coronary thrombus, which is interesting. You know, he didn't have like an overwhelming burden of atherosclerotic plaque that would rupture and lead to a thrombus to develop. So you do wonder, you know, did this thrombus develop in that artery, or did it somehow embolize there? Did it get there from someplace else in the body to lead to this ultimate syndrome? But still, the weird thing is, again, why these episodes are happening at all to this patient who has seemingly no other apparent risk factors that have been identified at this point. Additionally, they seem to be happening in the context of exercise. Whether that's related or not is kind of a bit of an assumption. There are some things, you know, that exist in as far as like a contextual trigger that can set off something like a myocardial infarction. For example, there's a relatively rare, it's pretty rare syndrome called like Kunis syndrome that's effectively like an allergic hypersensitivity type syndrome that can present as a heart attack like this. When somebody has like an allergic reaction, you get a heart attack, pretty dramatic type thing. In the context of exercise in this patient, I'm trying to find a way to link them. You know, there's obviously just some kind of like sympathetic adrenergic type activation, although that typically doesn't itself cause thrombosis. And so the bigger issue now is I'm trying to think about what sorts of factors could lead him to develop a blood clot in his coronary arteries. What kind of hypercoagulable condition could he have, for example, that could lead to an arterial thrombosis and a myocardial infarction? Could he have, you know, antiphospholipid syndrome as one among many examples of this kind of a thing that could set this off? So very unfortunate for him. I presume he, you know, as you mentioned, that sounds like he got urgent angiography and stent placement, but still need to think much more broadly about his potential, even though he doesn't have any overt risk factors for atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. There are many other underlying causes of hypercoagulability or things that can predispose patients to develop blood clots, like, for example, what I mentioned, antiphospholipid syndrome is one among many others, that there'd be a long list of workup for this type of a syndrome. So that's kind of the direction that I would probably go next.
Yeah, there you go. So you arrived in the correct neighborhood. They did a hypercoagulability workup that showed elevated factor 8 activity. So it was 210% higher than normal, but otherwise was negative for stuff like antiphospholipid syndrome, von Willebrand factor, et cetera. There's, like you said, a huge long list of this. And so, yeah, he was started again on some antiplatelet, anticoagulation therapy while in the hospital. He was discharged home on aspirin, atorvastatin, warfarin, and prasugrel. They DC'd the beta blocker, so they stopped doing the beta blocker because he had bradycardia. So they were like, let's take him off that. They also actually said, yeah, we took him off the ACE inhibitor because his creatinine level was high. But then they said, that was probably a mistake because he just was elevated muscle mass. Mm-hmm. So any thoughts on like a final diagnosis now with the hypercoagulability workup in mind?
Yeah, I mean, you just kind of told me that they did one and that that's all they found. So I don't know exactly which tests were performed beyond that. You mentioned that the factor 8 level is elevated. And I'm sure that there's a very particular syndrome that is not immediately coming to mind in which that is the case. More often when we think about factor 8, we're looking at it in a different context, more so in the context of bleeding than in thrombosis. So
yeah, no, that's exactly No, that's exactly right. So like you mentioned earlier, the hypercoagulability test includes a bunch of stuff. So factor VIII, antiphospholipid, protein S, C, APC resistance, et cetera, et cetera. All that stuff was normal. So it's just the factor VIII that was 205% more active than normal. And they had higher, much higher levels as well. And just as you mentioned, most of the time when you're looking at factor VIII, it's from the opposite. From having too little of it, you call it hemophilia A. Mm-hmm. But having an overabundance, this leads to thrombus, increased thrombotic like potential, as it is involved in the clotting cascade. And if it's overactive, you basically get too much clotting. Now, the majority of factor VIII overabundance seems to be genetic. Some studies estimate between 50 to 60%, but also an elevated BMI, which this patient has. His BMI was 39. African descent also seems to elevate the risk of having factor VIII overabundance. Female sex, elevated age, it seems to go up with age. And there's many other factors, including exercise. So exercise has been shown to increase factor VIII levels due to sympathetic nervous system activity. And this original study was done in 1984. There's nine dudes who did a graded exercise protocol test on a Wingate bike. So just this exercise bike that they can crank up the resistance to get people to go all the way to exhaustion. So they did this under three separate settings. Once was normal, so they had no additional like medications or anything on board. Once they gave them IV propranolol before the test. And the third was with this other beta blocker called carteolol. It's an eye-related beta blocker that people use, but they did an IV. So in any case, without the beta blockers on board, factor VIII rose about 44% on average across these nine subjects. And then when they gave them the IV propranolol, it didn't rise at all. So they abolished that response. Although when they subsequently tried to do this via oral propranolol, it doesn't work at all. And then it was cut in half with the other beta blocker when they gave that by IV infusion. So it seems like in individuals who have other risk factors for factor VIII overabundance, exercise could in fact be like a trigger, particularly because it does elevate. Although in normal individuals without other risk factors, it does seem like there's other additional mechanisms that compensate for this, basically to reduce the risk of thrombus formation. In fact, exercise seems to be net fibrinolytic, where people would effectively not clot as readily. So when people are listening to this, I don't want them to think like, oh, shoot, next time I exercise, I could get a blood clot. Probably not, unless, you know, you have some sort of weird risk factor here.
Super interesting case. One question for you. This is like probably veering a little bit far into the weeds here, but did this case report give you a PTT measurement?
They had on the hypercoagulability workup, they did an activated partial thromboplastin time at APTT, and it was 31.1. So normal would be 25 to 35.
Okay, because I would you know, you could make an argument, or you might expect that somebody with a, you know, a very strong tendency to clot due to an elevation in this, that their PTT would actually be shortened, and that would be a tip off to something like this.
Yeah, but you was probably already medicated at the time, you know, when they did this. They did this blood test, so
yeah,
that's probably
that would
why
have been
he wasn't.
That would have been an interesting tip off. And I tried looking this up. There's not apparently like a name for this syndrome. It's, you know, just like a thing that can happen, which, you know, I'm not surprised that it can happen. It's not something I've actually heard of before, but satisfying to recognize that, you know, I think the structured thinking through the case would have led us to the appropriate place. And then, yeah, if I had gotten a shortened PTT, I think I would have gotten even a step closer than that. So anyway.
Yeah, I do wonder, you know, if they had tested that prior to initiating the acute coronary syndrome on his first hospital admission, would they have picked that up and been like, that's interesting. But yeah, I'd more interested to know, like, if he would have been adherent to the medication protocol he was on, would he have avoided this? But, you know, subsequently he was discharged. I believe he was on warfarin when he went home, just again to prevent this thrombus formation. You know, interesting. I knew that factor VIII was a thing, right? But again, mostly related to hemophilia A. But I was like, oh, I guess it could theoretically go the other way.
Yeah.
And speaking of satisfying, this is by far the most satisfying case report I've ever read, with all the information that they provided and like imaging and EKGs and stuff. I'm like, now this, my friend, is a case report worth reviewing. So
yeah, well done. I learned something today. That's good.
There you go. Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to get into the main portion of this podcast, Great Debates in Fitness and in Health. I think this is our seventh one. We've done a few of these, and these are fun because sometimes we get to have to manufacture artificial stances that we don't actually hold to argue against one another, but I kind of like arguing. So
let's do it.
Yeah. The format here. So we're giving ourselves about 5 minutes per question. And we'll alternate who goes first, picking the affirmative or the negative, 2 minutes each way, and then a 1 minute rebuttal at the end. It's a loose program though. So don't start your, don't sync your watches to this. It's not going to work like that. But because I'm the reigning champion, I think everyone agrees. Everyone has universally said that I've been the reigning champion. I'm going to let you go first on this one, picking the affirmative or the negative. And yeah, we'll see how we do. All right. First up, your favorite topic, fish oil. Fish oil is a type of polyunsaturated fat. It's called an omega-3 fatty acid because it has a carbon-carbon double bond located three carbons from the end of the chain. This is called the omega-3 position. There are several different types of omega-3 unsaturated fatty acids, but the majority of the scientific research focuses on three: ALA, EPA, and DHA. Now, ALA is present in plant oils such as flaxseed, soybean, and canola oils, whereas DHA and EPA are present in fish oils, and krill oils. But they are originally synthesized by microalgae, not by fish themselves. Now, most American adults consume about 90 milligrams of omega-3 fatty acids per day, which is the equivalent of about 4 ounces of cooked salmon. While deficiency of omega-3 fatty acids, or fatty acid deficiency in general, those are both very rare in the developed world, really only occurring in the hospital setting where those who are receiving parenteral nutrition or IV nutrition, not fortified with essential fatty acids, that's pretty much the only time it occurs. Regular consumption of fish is often promoted as health-promoting due to its omega-3 fatty acid content, and many claim that those who don't consume fish regularly should take a fish oil supplement. So the premise is people who don't eat fish regularly should take fish oil to improve their health. Austin, what say you?
Sure. I'll take the affirmative here. So I think that overall, when we look at kind of the broader body of evidence on nutritional kind of outcomes, we have more than enough evidence to pretty strongly recommend that people consume a couple servings of fatty fish per week for various outcomes in terms of cardiovascular health. And you could extend it a bit beyond that. The EPA component seems to be the more predominant one as it relates to cardiovascular health. I see, some arguments that the DHA component tends to be more pertinent to some neurological kind of outcomes. And so when I'm discussing nutrition with patients or from folks who want kind of general nutrition advice, I very consistently will advise that people consume some kind of fatty fish, like salmon, for example, twice a week if they're able to, if they find that palatable, they can prepare it in a way that they are willing to consume. Then I tend to pretty regularly recommend that as part of my routine advice to folks. And so the question here, the premise would be like, if somebody is not willing to or able to do that for any reason, should they? And, should versus shouldn't, I don't know that I'm, willing to go quite that far, but rather if I'm framing it through the lens of like, for people who don't eat fish regularly or unwilling or unable to do this, would they stand to benefit from some sort of fish oil supplementation? And I think that they could potentially gain some of those health benefits through, high quality, sufficiently dosed EPA or DHA supplementation as it relates to certain cardiovascular outcomes, most strongly in the secondary prevention context. We have strongest evidence for that, but also I could also see it in the primary prevention scenario. And so then that brings us to the last issue, which may be your point of contention, is that the source and the dose of that particular supplementation, if somebody is going to do it, is fraught. So this is not as simple as, well, if I'm not going to eat fish, then I just go buy any old bottle of fish oil over the counter from my grocery store or something like that. I generally do not trust the purity of their formulations, the quality of that, and the doses are typically, inadequate as well. And so I think you're less likely to benefit and actually potentially likely to be harmed by just like any old run-of-the-mill over-the-counter grocery store type of fish oil supplement compared with something that is more tested quality and sufficient dosing of EPA and DHA components for somebody who is never going to consume fish in their regular diet. I think that they do actually stand to benefit, to gain those benefits, some of them at least, that they would otherwise get from fish via supplementation.
Yeah, so if I'm forced to take the negative here, then yeah, I have to come at this from the point of people who don't eat fish, will never eat fish in their dietary pattern, whether they're vegan, vegetarian, or just won't eat fish otherwise, that the problem would surround over-the-counter fish oil supplementation, mainly because the dosing is suspect and also the purity is suspect. And then even the subsequent outcomes when directly measured are not very good for improving, risk of first time cardiovascular disease, for example, cancer risk reduction, you know, you could go down the list. It's just not that great, which is why we don't generally recommend fish over-the-counter fish oil supplementation in general. I think for people who are interested in fish oil, or especially those who would stand to benefit from fish consumption or fish oil supplementation. So those would be individuals who are on a plant-based diet, for example, or those who would otherwise not eat fish. If they got a prescription for one of these kind of synthetic isomer type fish oils, so Vascepa, for example, or what's the other one, Austin, off the top of your head? Do you remember?
Laveza.
Yeah. Yeah, I always call it Laveza, and I always feel like an idiot saying it. So Laveza is probably the correct one. I think if you got those prescribed to you and that was something that you could do, I would probably be more on board with that. And I'd say that the benefits are more likely to be positive than negative. So it either be neutral, like not do anything, or potentially be positive. Whereas I feel more strongly that over-the-counter fish oil supplementation is more likely to cause harm than any benefit. So it'd be more like neutral to negative. So that's how I would have to approach this. Which is, again, is why we don't generally recommend fish oil supplementation if it's coming from over-the-counter sources. Yeah, so I think that's how I'd have to take that.
Yeah, I think that that's a reasonable take. I don't know that it necessarily has to be one of the prescription products. It's just that we have not personally vetted any of the other ones to know in terms of the quality and testing and dosing in the same way that, you know, you've given guidelines, for example, to people before as far as supplements go to like, here's what you should look for on the label. And we've not gone through and like,
hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. Summer is here, and that means a lot of you are going to want to spend more time outside and less time on meal prep, all while staying on track with your nutrition. For many, a meal prep service like Factor can bridge that gap. Now, I've been using Factor for a while now, just here and there when I'm spending more time away from home or don't have time to cook, and it's made my day delicious and easy. Meals are ready in just 2 minutes, and they have everything from breakfast to dinner and even dessert. So you can stay fueled with easy, nutritious options. They also have 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons. I am a creature of habit, but there's a lot of different stuff to choose from, so you'll always have new flavors to explore. So head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. I wanted to take a second to talk about our new podcast sponsor, Mint Mobile. With big wireless providers, what you see is never what you get. Somewhere between the store and your first month's bill, the price you thought you were paying magically skyrockets. With Mint Mobile, you'll never have to worry about gotchas ever again, because when they say $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan, they mean it. There's no surprise monthly bills and unexpected overages. They have premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month. And all plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/BBM. That's mintmobile.com/BBM. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/BBM. $45 upfront payment required, that's equivalent to $15 a month, and this is limited to new customers on a first 3-month plan only. Speeds are slower above 40 gigabytes on the unlimited plan, and additional taxes, fees, and restrictions may apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
American Giant makes great clothing, t-shirts, jeans, and more right here in the U.S., creating jobs in towns and cities across the country. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Vetted any like particular fish oil supplement. The last caveat I would mention is, you know, another strong reason to encourage it to come from fish is that you could eat all the fish you want, you know, and you're not going to suffer a negative consequence as it relates to the omega-3 component. Whereas if you took all the fish oil in the world, you know, there is a signal, an association between some of these fish oil supplements at particular doses and new onset atrial fibrillation. Yeah. We've talked about this a little bit before, which is an irregular heart rhythm that can increase the risk of stroke. and some other negative things. And so this is also why, another reason why I wouldn't go about doing this willy-nilly. Dosing and quality matters here. And I would prefer that that dosing and quality come from an actual fish whenever possible. But again, if somebody's like, no chance, no way, then I think that if they want to try to gain those potential benefits that there are to be had, then it can be done, knowing or recognizing that with via supplemental forms, there is some risk, even though it's not massive, of atrial fibrillation.
And some bleeding risk if you overdose on this stuff, potentially. And yeah, I don't know if those sort of synthetic forms that are the prescription forms of fish oil, I don't know if that's the like uniquely beneficial type, like the way that they structure them are like way better than the over-the-counter stuff. But I know that the purity is better, it is a general rule. And so, yeah, I think that's where I would kind of hedge my bets.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's move on. So second question, this is on obesity and the rate of weight loss. So obesity is a chronic relapsing disease of neurobehavioral origin, wherein an increase in body fat promotes a wide variety of health consequences affecting over 40% of American adults. While weight loss, or more specifically fat loss, is the definitive treatment of the condition for eligible individuals, there's a lot of confusion surrounding the best approach. There's currently a consensus of what constitutes successful weight loss or clinically meaningful weight loss, which is achieving and maintaining at least 5% loss from the initial starting weight. Still, there's much speculation about the ideal rate of weight loss. So the premise is weight should be lost slowly, so like 1% a week or similar, as this is more likely to lead to achieving and sustaining clinically significant weight loss, in addition to reducing the burden of disease attributed to excess body fat. So I will take the lead here, and I will respond in the negative that I do not think that weight should necessarily be lost slowly. And in order to answer this, I think we can look at existing evidence comparing different rates of weight loss, and that kind of informs my answer here. While I would admit that there's some signal that faster weight loss, so losing more than 1% per week, or maybe in some cases multiples more than that, tends to lead to a maybe worse body composition outcomes, particularly in highly trained individuals, meaning that they will tend to lose more lean body mass compared to doing a more gradual approach. At a population level, this is not a concern at all. So in general, people who are carrying too much body fat, who need to lose weight, who would benefit from losing weight, if they lose weight more quickly, it does not really seem to cause more lean body mass loss. And even if it did, that's kind of a risk you're willing to take in order to get the weight off, because the improvement in health from the fat loss is far greater than the detriment in health from the potential muscle mass loss. So that's thing one. Thing two, there's no real difference in adherence rates, meaning that if you do it slower, like people are better able to sustain weight loss long-term. In fact, the rates are effectively identical. And finally, quicker weight loss or faster weight loss does seem to actually encourage more weight loss in general. And so when you think about the amount of weight that most people need to lose, especially at a population level, it doesn't really make sense to go gradually unless that's their preferred approach and that's how they're going to be adherent to the thing. So I suspect that the way my colleague will approach this is through like a personal preference kind of thing, in which case I have no rebuttal to that because I'm on board. But I think if you were trying to make a broad sweeping recommendation about ideal like loss of weight, effectively it would be whatever the person will adhere to. And after that, I would probably choose faster is better outside of like the highly competitive athlete where muscle mass matters the most.
Okay. The way I'll counter your position, I suppose, is to look at it through the lens of like, should weight be lost as quickly as possible? And I could make the case that no, it shouldn't necessarily, because there are some potential ways to do that would be unsafe. So in other words, the way that I'm looking at this is it should be lost slowly insofar as there's like a safety concern with going faster. And that comes down to like what your choice of method is to actually induce this weight loss. Because you can lose quote unquote weight through a lot of means. It is important in the original kind of outline that you specified relating to fat loss, right? Because somebody could, overdose and take a whole bunch of diuretics or laxatives or something like that, and you can lose an enormous amount of weight in a few hours or a day or two. And you could also put yourself into kidney failure and land yourself hospitalized with an arrhythmia from hypokalemia or something like that, right? So I think that, the ways that I would kind of adjust the premise here is relating to making sure, qualifying it as fat loss in particular, rather than just weight loss, because that opens you up to a whole bunch of other means of potential weight loss, including things like amputation, which would not be advisable to lose weight here. And then also just with consideration of the safety aspect of it. You know, there are potential consequences. So for example, I don't know that you considered this necessarily, but to the extent that somebody loses weight relatively quickly, there actually are some potential downsides of something like that, even when it is just straight fat loss. There's a relatively uncommon syndrome that can manifest called SMA syndrome, superior mesenteric artery syndrome, where you lose a little bit of the body fat between that artery and your aorta, and then it ends up kind of pinching off part of your bowel, and you can end up with some abdominal pain issues and obstruction and things like that. That's just one among, not a massive list, but a handful of, actual medical complications of rapid weight loss, to your point. Yeah, gallstones being another one. So, safety of the method is something that I would prioritize here. And then if the method is safe and the person is able to adhere to it over time, then I'm good with it. And then, roll with it, and you're likely to enjoy a lot of health benefits. And there is, a very tiny potential risk of some downsides or medical complications, but those should not factor into this decision if somebody has obesity.
Yeah, I think it's not so much a rebuttal, but more of a counter, we'll say, to my colleague's take, because I actually know where he stands on this, is that when you look at the rate of weight loss from the use of anti-obesity medications and or metabolic surgery, for example, the rate far exceeds this 1% per week, and you are decidedly in favor of those.
Yeah.
Which it doesn't actually go against what you said, but you feel like the safety sort of index for how quickly weight can be lost is actually far greater than this sort of very slow rate that's often being pushed.
Yes.
And so I would just go back to, I think that maybe upper limit of what is safe or acceptable is likely much higher. I don't know a specific number, but it's way higher than 1% per week. Yeah. But there is some sort of upper level that you'd be like, that's probably not worth the risk. Although I will still say, when people support this sort of gradual weight loss from a stance of, well, people are more likely to be adherent to it long term, that's decidedly not true. But people are going to lose way more muscle mass. I'm like, maybe in very trained, like already relatively lean individuals, that may be true. But at a population level, probably not a big concern. Like, oh, well, there's way more medical risk at going faster versus slower. It's like, well, it depends how fast you're talking. If you're talking again, and how you're achieving that. Mm-hmm. But in general, I don't think that any of the currently available strategies we have for fat loss tend to get to that rate without really trying hard to run that ragged edge. Even in cases where people are fasting for extended periods of time, that can be well tolerated. So, All right. Third question, Austin, you're going to take the lead on this. This is about the exercise guidelines, maybe your second favorite topic. You can't get enough of it. The current exercise guidelines for both adults and children recommend regularly engaging in both resistance training and conditioning exercise. The prevalence of those meeting the muscle strengthening guidelines among U.S. adults has increased about 20%. Over the past 20 years, with a smaller increase of about 10% for those meeting both of the lifting and conditioning recommendations in the same time period. Now, we know that both types of exercise generate health-promoting adaptations. So bone mineral density improves and muscle function improves from resistance training, and you get better cardiorespiratory capacity with conditioning. They also share significant overlap in chronic disease risk reduction, such as certain forms of cancer, type 2 diabetes, and so on, though they do so through different mechanisms. Still, some may wonder if it's better to focus on one type of exercise over the other. So the premise is, more health benefits would be seen on a population level by people doing more conditioning exercise that would lead to a 10% increase in VO2 max compared to doing more resistance training, leading to a 10% increase in strength. Austin, what do you say?
I will grant you, this is a pretty interesting question to think to think about. There probably is an actual like evidence-based answer to this type of thing that can be obtained. I do not have sufficient command of those data to immediately cite them with great confidence. However, the position I'll take is that yes, people would be more likely to benefit from doing more conditioning exercise leading to 10% increase in the VO2 max than a 10% increase in strength. And the main reasons that I am kind of coming to this conclusion is in terms of when we look at data on the relationship between these variables and risk of death, for example, as the the most hard outcome. VO2 max appears to be a even more potent, have an even tighter, even stronger relationship with that outcome than strength does, in terms of how can what's the term, like monotonic, I guess would be the term. In other words, that as VO2 max continues to increase, then the risk of mortality continues to decrease. It is like, it is not necessarily straight linear, but it is a continuous relationship in that direction. The higher it goes, the lower the risk of death, even up to like elite levels of cardiorespiratory fitness. Whereas as it relates to strength, you know, I, for sure, both of us are, yeah, strength evangelists. We hope people get stronger. And I see the consequences in terms of health and function and risk of death of people with insufficient physical strength every single day in the hospital. However, the population that rotates through the hospital between hospitals and rehab facilities, as unfortunate as it is, and that's like most of my day to day, that is a relatively small fraction of the overall population. And when, you know, we've looked at this as far as like how strong do you actually need to get, et cetera, in the past, the benefits as far as strength increase tend to level off at relatively low levels of strength. In other words, you don't have to, you know, you don't see continued benefits from somebody taking their squat from 100 pounds to 400 pounds to 800 pounds, right? If you go from like, you know, untrained up to elite levels of strength, that is not something that we actually see. Whereas with VO2 max as a you know, partial indicator of cardiorespiratory fitness, we do see continued improvements going from low levels to, you know, moderate levels to elite levels of cardiorespiratory fitness. So I think that that's kind of the way that I'm conceptualizing this, and why I would take the affirmative that yes, people should do more conditioning.
Yeah. I agree that this is definitely an answerable question using scientific evidence, although there'd be a number of leaps you'd have to make and a lot of speculation, but you could, like, I think, support it well with some scientific evidence. And the big problem here I have with the premise is that the 10% number, admittedly, I created the 10% number. So, like, I don't know if a better number is 20%, 30%. Yeah. And I actually think the higher that number becomes, the more in favor of VO2 max it probably is supporting, because again, that dose dependent relationship between VO2 max and sort of all-cause mortality, certainly cardiovascular disease risk, and so on. And also because a VO2 max test, in order to get that high level, you still have to have an adequately working musculoskeletal system too, right? You can't just be like heart and lungs and no muscle and still like do well on a graded treadmill test or graded exercise bike test, something like that. So with those problems like kind of at the forefront here, I am also forced to take the opposite position, that the increase in strength would be more beneficial right now. And so the only way I can really come to that is because we do have an aging population where the risk of sarcopenia and poor quality of life and lack of function, independent living, et cetera, is so high that perhaps that small increase in strength would actually significantly improve population level health, whereas a similar level of improvement of VO2 max wouldn't really change much right now. 20 years from now, that may switch. And if you change the numbers from 10% to 20% or 30%, that may also change. But ultimately, I suspect it'd be really hard to really confidently say one way or the other. I just think right now with the aging population, I probably lean more towards strength, although I don't know what that number is, which kind of goes back to what I've said previously about the current guidelines and their deficiencies. It's like, you want to know, like, how strong do people need to get, right? Or a range of like strength improvement that correlates best with long-term health outcomes. Same thing for conditioning. How conditioned do people need to get? Not just the prescription for like a dose, because that dose is not going to produce those level, those adaptations routinely across the population. And so I think having those targets would be useful from a prescription standpoint and also a monitoring standpoint. You're like, oh, look, you've been exercising, meeting these current guidelines, but you haven't yet achieved this VO2 max threshold that we know correlates with the long and healthy lifespan, right? Or health span, if you wanted to use that terminology. Same thing with strength. Like, and you would prefer to have those sort of metrics on board when you prescribe exercise.
Yeah, I think I'm with you there. And for that selected population at the low end, in terms of like sarcopenia, frailty, things like that, I think that almost either way or any way that you train them will be likely to improve both. In other words, yeah, if you get them stronger, their VO2 max is likely to go up just because they're like able to do the task more. And if you could somehow snap your fingers and increase their VO2 max, well, the only way they can express that is with an increased, you know, force output.
Strength,
and so at that low end, it almost matters even less. They're going to improve both things. And then at the high end, it seems that the VO2 max seems to be the more predominant variable as it relates to health outcomes.
Yeah. So maybe we just take issue with the premise to be like, look, in this hypothetical scenario, you can improve VO2 max, but not strength. And in the strength improving scenario, you can improve strength, but not VO2 max. Yeah. And it's like, dang it, this doesn't seem physiologically plausible, but fair enough. All right. Next debate question. I'll take the lead on this. Fiber is defined as an edible, non-digestible component of carbohydrates that is intrinsic and intact only in plants. In general, fiber is involved in how quickly the stomach empties, digestion, and transit time through the gut. It also alters binding and absorption of certain dietary compounds, including carcinogens. Dietary patterns that are high in fiber are repeatedly shown to generate better health outcomes compared to diets that are lower in fiber, all else being equal. The current recommendation for men and women is to get about 38 and 25 grams per day of fiber, respectively, or about 14 grams of fiber per 1,000 calories consumed. Now, based on the current research, only about 6% of Americans consume this much fiber, despite the overwhelming majority of adults believing fiber is healthy, and nearly 60% are trying to eat more fiber-containing foods. Still, the average intake for fiber is about 20 grams per day for men and 15 grams per day for women in the United States. In contrast to the public health focus on dietary fiber intake, many in the fitness space promote increasing dietary protein as an important key for health and results. As a reminder, the average protein intake in the United States is about 1.1 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day, and the current evidence shows that achieving a protein intake of about 1.4 to 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day pretty much maximizes exercise-related adaptations. So the premise is, health would improve on a population level if dietary fiber intake was promoted as much as dietary protein intake in the health and fitness space. I will take the affirmative here that health would improve more if all of the current fitfluencers, trainers, etc., people promoting eat more dietary protein, eat more protein, if they switch that messaging to dietary fiber. And instead of it being like high protein meal ideas, high protein snack ideas, to be high fiber snack ideas, high fiber meal ideas or meal plans, mainly because we're so close already to this sort of what we need to get from dietary protein to maximize like exercise related adaptations, that the hangup really isn't like protein intake. It's just getting people to exercise. So I would take that same energy and focus it on exercise. And if I had to pick a dietary pattern strategy or intervention or change, it would be to eat more dietary fiber, which would overall reduce the consumption of ultra-processed foods with added sugars, added fats, added sodium, and things like that. And I think that would actually move the needle. I suspect that my colleague will come at this from a side, attack my flank, and say, it doesn't matter what these idiots recommend because nobody's going to change what they do anyway. So what are you talking about, bro? But we'll see what you have to say.
No, not a bad flank. I'll come from the other flank and say that, if I'm forced to take the negative on this, which I really prefer not to do, but as I have no choice here, it would be that I think that depending on the way that such advice was given, a lot of folks might default to the use of fiber supplements. And so, insofar as dietary protein goes, you can get the vast majority of the benefits of protein, whether it comes from a food source or from a protein supplement, like a whey protein, for example, as it relates to something like muscle growth, for example. Of course, there are going to be other nutrients, for example, that come in particular protein sources, be it some kind of a, Greek yogurt or an egg or some kind of meat or fish or something like that. There are other things that come along with it. But just restricting ourselves to the protein component, those benefits, particularly as it relates to muscle mass accretion and things like that, you can get equivalent outcomes, whether it's from food or from a supplement. And so if that mentality is extrapolated to this side, where you have a whole bunch of fiber-rich foods in the diet that you can get, various fruits, vegetables, berries, oats, lentils, legumes, things like that, that contain tons of fiber, if the mentality is, I can just similarly get the same effects from just, a scoop of psyllium husk or something like that, that is definitively not the case. You can get some benefits, mainly in terms of lipid lowering through fiber supplementation, but a lot of the other benefits that there are to be had from those types of foods, you will not actually get from a fiber supplement as opposed to from the food itself. So aside from that, I'll, I otherwise tend to agree that I actually think that fiber should be emphasized even more. There are some folks in the space who are pretty annoying around this topic, because they string together a series of claims that, as I've stated before, like sound good if you don't know what you're talking about or if you don't think about them, and it leads you to an incorrect conclusion. So, for example, they'll talk about how important a protein is for muscle gain. It's like, sure, okay. Therefore, we should get a lot of protein in our diet. And it's like, well, okay. I mean, there is an actual dose range that would be recommended, but they just seem to imply for the most part that more is better. And that the way to get the best results out of your dietary protein intake is for it to come from the absolute most bioavailable sources all the time and not to consume any quote unquote inferior or less bioavailable sources, which is nonsensical. So they say, you know, you should consume enormous amounts of protein and it should all be derived from animal foods. And because they're inferior, you should not actually bother with any of these other like plant sources of protein because they're inferior. And we've talked about this before, that once you get to this sufficient dose range, say you're into this, you know, 1.2, 1.4, 1.6 grams per kilo per day, or certainly higher than that, you have an abundance of this protein coming in. And it actually doesn't matter whether it's coming from plant sources or animal sources. And most of the time, you know, people are consuming mixed dietary meals. And so you, even if it is a vegan or vegetarian diet with multiple plant-based protein sources being consumed to that level, you can end up with, you know, all of the amino acids that you need, including the essential ones that you're very worried about. And so the overall dose is what matters there. And I would not expect a significant difference in outcomes there as compared with, you know, consuming 100% straight beef for something like that based on the available evidence.
Yeah. Rather than rebut what you said, I actually have a sidebar to this. What if the same people who are advocating for consuming more protein, and also I should say, I don't think that people who say this are idiots. I think they're well-meaning. In general, I think once you get to that level of like, okay, I'm going to put out information that I want to be helpful. Like, not only are you trying to do the right thing, but you're also relatively informed because you're just, you know, that's good. So I say that in jest. No, don't come at me for that sort of nomenclature. But what if instead of saying, hey, just eat more protein, they said eat more plant protein. And you switched all of the messaging. Don't just eat more protein, aim for a gram per pound a day, whatever, but eat more plant protein to your diet. Don't, you know, you don't have to change much else, but eat more plant protein to get to this dose level. What do you think about that?
I mean, I do that routinely in my own diet. Like a fair amount of my like carb sources is like lentils and legumes that have both carbs and protein and fiber all in them.
That's what I'm saying. So you're getting both at the same time. You're getting the more protein. So hey, look, we don't even have to like rob Peter to pay Paul, but then we also get the fiber thing. Maybe we'll do that. Maybe that's our public health messaging. Eat more plant-based protein.
Have some lentils, and if you're still worried about it, you can throw down a whey shake and get your animal-derived protein source, and you'll be good to go. And have some Greek yogurt and then some berries and some oats, and you know, you're in good shape.
Yeah, Big Dairy and Big Bean are both happy with our message.
I just summarized like a decent chunk of my regular diet. There you go.
There you go. All right. Last debate premise. Austin, you're going to take the lead on this. Physical activity is a huge problem worldwide and is the number four global risk factor for mortality, according to the World Health Organization, behind high blood pressure, tobacco use, and elevated blood sugar. Insufficient physical activity predisposes to a wide variety of chronic diseases, including cardio and cerebrovascular disease, metabolic disease, musculoskeletal disorders, frailty, and many others. Similarly, musculoskeletal pain is a huge problem when it comes to an individual's quality of life and is also a barrier to participating in exercise. It has recently been suggested by some that people should routinely see a physical therapist in order to improve health, presumably by treating injuries and or reducing the risk of injuries while also promoting exercise to their patients. Physical therapists have been billed as experts in exercise, according to both the 2019 World Confederation for Physical Therapy Policy Statement and the 2020 American Physical Therapy Association position stand on health promotion. Still, only 13% of physical therapists surveyed across a wide range of specialties were able to correctly identify the current exercise guidelines, and only 41% of them reported regularly promoting exercise in the clinic. The premise is, people should see a physical therapist regularly like they do their physician in order to improve health. Austin, you want to take the lead on this?
Oh boy, you're dragging me into your threads argument that you got yourself into. I'm going to take the negative here. I do not think that people need to regularly see a physical therapist, you know, from a preventative standpoint, for example. And to be clear, I barely think that people need to see a physician regularly, you know, just from a, from if they're completely, you know, asymptomatic, healthy, outside of making sure that like very basic, you know, screening measures are undertaken, like, you know, making sure that their blood pressure and like high risk behaviors are addressed and things like that. So this isn't like, you know, professional protectionism here or something to say that they should only come and see me. It's like, no, I mean, meet these basic screening guidelines. And then, you know, if you're like in your 20s or something, yeah, like I don't need to see you, you know, all the time. If you have a certain condition that needs monitoring, okay. If you have a certain complaint that you would like to get assessed, happy to see you. And to keep you up to date on the screenings that would be advisable for you, you know, be it blood pressure or certain immunizations or something like that, then cool. But short of that, no. Annual physicals, not necessary, not great evidence that they're super beneficial for the majority of like generally healthy people who are otherwise meeting their basic kind of screening and preventative care needs. So that's like the initial caveat up front. And so I'd take a similar approach here. So, you know, I would be interested to see what sort of claims are made around, you know, somebody suggesting that patients should routinely see a physical therapist, be it from a preventative standpoint, for example. I could see, for example, them making the claim that, well, you could screen patients for, you know, asymmetries or like quote unquote movement dysfunction or pain or something like that that needs to be addressed or, you know, technique stuff. And this just brings us back to our basic concepts of screening, right? So like, what are the things that make for a effective screening type of intervention? It should be looking at something that is a widespread prevalent problem. It should be something that involves an assessment that is cost effective, that is, you know, very sensitive, and that has an effective intervention treatment that can significantly alter the patient's downstream, you know, trajectory of health, morbidity, mortality, et cetera. And literally none of that evidence exists as it relates to screening prior to engagement in physical activity. We don't have any, you know, effective screening programs really on a population level that lead to like markedly better outcomes from exercise or markedly reduced injury risk from exercise. And that's just because exercise is pretty safe. A, interventions to reduce the risk of pain and injury, B, are not terribly effective for the most part. There are some, you know, programs here and there that are employed in the context of sports to say reduce the risk of, you know, hamstring tear, you know, strains and ACL injuries and things like that, which is a different context than we're talking about broad population level, you know, just basic exercise engagement. And so I just do not think that somebody who makes a claim that this should be the case would have a great evidence base to back them up outside of like vibes. They'd just be like, it seems like it should be useful for them to see a physical therapist for this. And I do not buy that argument as something that is that, I mean, the bar that you must clear for a like population-wide screening program to be effective is appropriately very high in order to demonstrate efficacy and cost effectiveness and all sorts of other things. You know, and even from the standpoint of like aches and pains, like, yeah, pain is common. The vast majority of aches and pains resolve on their own. This is like saying that like every human should see a physician every time they get a cold. And it's like, please no, like you don't need to see me for a cold. Just get over it, basically. Like take some NSAIDs and you'll be okay, right? That would be severe over medicalization of something that is likely to resolve on its own, in the same way that the vast majority of aches and pains, even acute back pain, we frequently, you know, compare it to the onset of a cold, right? It comes on, it can get pretty bad, it can get pretty debilitating. The vast majority get better on their own, a tiny fraction have something else going on, et cetera, et cetera. And so unless there's some other reason, some other red flag or something like that that merits investigation, most of them will get better. And so like every case of pain needs to be investigated by a physical therapist. No more than every case of pain needs to be investigated by a physician or a CT scan or some sort of professional clinician. So I fear for the over-medicalization of the population if this ends up being a thing. Yeah, that's my initial position.
All right. So I am forced to say, to take the affirmative that everybody should see a physical therapist regularly, like they do their physician, to improve health. Yeah. It is interesting that people assume that like, oh, we're just trying to protect like professional, like, you know, scope, reach, encroachment and stuff. And it's like, no, we don't think that you should see us either. Like, that's not the case. It's just that there's unclear benefit that if we just snapped our fingers and overnight everybody had a booked appointment with their local physical therapist, that things would improve any more than you snapped your finger and everybody had access to a local, primary care doc. I would actually suspect that maybe the latter might catch some, undiagnosed, like high blood pressure, for example, or like depression screening or like other high risk behaviors. And you can, maybe there's some benefit there. But if I'm forced to take the affirmative, I got to do it through a special way here. So if I think about all the policy changes that would need to happen for this to be a thing, I think the way I'd have to frame this would be that this would be like a musculoskeletal health type appointment, right? Musculoskeletal health checkup, mainly to be like, hey, are you currently exercising, to do the physical activity as a vital signs, or come up with a better screen, which I'm working on, right now with some help. And if you're not, like, what are some ways that we can get you to do that? Now, you would have to shore up some of the fund of knowledge and behavior change counseling skills on physical therapists, get them up to speed on programming and exercise prescription and the behavior change stuff, motivational interviewing. But I think that is a bridge that can be built with much less work than not only other healthcare professionals, but certainly like non-healthcare professionals. So you could even make the case like, oh, everyone should be able to see a personal trainer, like a certified personal trainer. And it's like, well, that's one thought, but I think there's more education, more of a process to get those folks up to speed compared to physical therapists, just because of their fund of knowledge that they already have and their experience working with in the clinical setting. So I think it's possible, if you were able to bridge that gap with, maybe it's a course, a certification or something, in order for you to like take these musculoskeletal health appointments, that could be net beneficial, I think, if you for like exercise promotion and monitoring, I'd be on board with that. I probably wouldn't be on board with like injury screening or like, hey, you got an injury that, you've thought about in the last 12 months. Like, let's work on that. It'd be more from an exercise promotion thing. And I think that physical therapists are generally positioned well to do that, but there probably would need to be some additional, like a certification or a course that is undertaken on a population level or like, federal level, for that to work, broadly speaking. So I think that's how I would take it.
The last thing I'll say here is I think this is a scenario where I would advise be careful what you wish for. I think that actually, if something like this were to happen, where suddenly everybody had a primary care physical therapist that they had access to, I think PTs would hate.
Oh, that. Yeah, I'm sure. You're right. Yeah, 100%. 100%.
Because, they have a niche and an interest. And if most of their day, instead of being booked up with people who are, maybe perioperative, maybe sports injuries, maybe other sorts of pathologies that actually require skilled physical therapy services, if most of that was replaced with just like screening against the exercise guidelines and general physical activity recommendations, and that would end up becoming the majority of your clinical day. I don't think they would like that.
Well, it's the same thing. What the sort of checkups that were being done by handled by like PAs and stuff like that. It was like, okay, if you're over a certain age and you haven't had a screen and this, you come in and you do it, it's 30 minutes, 45 minutes, you get reimbursed a very low rate, for example. That's the same thing that would happen here. Your calendar would be filled with these sessions that would probably, pay you out $20. And you're like, I don't know how to do this. And then there'd be a lot of weird stuff that would happen downstream from this. So some unintended consequences. But I do think that, if we build this as a musculoskeletal health thing, health promotion through exercise, PTs are generally well positioned to do this. And certainly there's some great PTs that we've met through our journey here who would, could lead the charge here. And while I think those individuals are relatively rare, I do again think that there's a smaller bridge to gap bridge that gap in general. And so I'd be optimistic, but yeah, you're right. Some negative externalities that would certainly occur. So
yeah, I mean, think about it this way, like, leading cause of death worldwide, cardiovascular disease. Mm-hmm. Should everyone have a primary cardiologist?
Should everyone get an EKG?
Their whole day involves listening to people's hearts for abnormal heart sounds.
Yeah.
The popularity of cardiology as a fellowship.
That we have nobody.
Nobody would do it anymore. Exactly.
Yeah. Good point.
Careful with over-medicalization, careful with over-diagnosis, careful with screening, careful what you wish for. Totally. That's my conclusion.
Yeah, caveat emptor. Yeah, sure. All right, that's a wrap here on episode 301 of the Barbell Medicine Podcast. We had a mystery case. We had some great debates. We also introduced our new calculators over on the website. So you can click to those, go to the website, click on About Us, click the Resources tab, and you get some cool calculators that might help you or a friend out. Also, the Android app is live in the Google Play Store. So if you're a Green Bubble person, check that out. And we have a template quiz if you're on the fence for a new template. That's linked in the description below. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. Thanks to Dr. Austin Baracchi for joining me here on the podcast. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. What are your self-care non-negotiables? It's hard to make time for the things that keep you healthy, but being consistent with self-care is like working a muscle. And when life gets crazy, that muscle keeps you strong. Therapy is the ultimate self-care, and BetterHelp makes it easy to get started with affordable online sessions you can do from anywhere. Never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com today to get 10% off your first month.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.